This is Fresh Air. In times of war, it is often writers and artists who give voice to our most powerful emotions, either in dissent or support. We're trying to find and understand voices from all different sides of this conflict. We'll hear from some of them over the next half hour. First, Dabia Khamis. She's a writer in exile from the United Arab Emirates, one of the Gulf states bordering Kuwait. She was educated in the U.S. and England. When she returned to her country in the late 1980s, she was imprisoned for her writing. Khamis lives in Cairo. She's lived there for the past 2 years. She's returned to her country several times to visit her family. But since the war, flights in and out of the United Arab Emirates have been suspended. I phoned Dabia Khamis in Cairo earlier today and asked her where her heart was during the war.
My heart has always been shattered before and after the war. I guess part of it is that my home in the Gulf, and part of it is here in Cairo, and the other part is probably in Iraq. I have never been to Iraq. I have never lived in Iraq. But I was saying from the beginning of this war, it seems to me while I'm watching TV and reading newspapers, as if my heart has been put on a plate and I have been eating it with a fork and a knife.
Can I ask you how your day-to-day life has been changed by the outbreak of war?
For the first 5 days, 4 days, I was not able to sleep at all. I had to go to the doctor to get an injection to be able to go to sleep. We were listening to news all the time, watching CNN news, reading newspapers. Because I'm from the Gulf and I'm living in Cairo, I had been seeing a lot of hostile attitudes, but not any. They are not really expressed. Yeah, I feel as if we are blamed as Gulf people to what happened in Iraq. People are against Saddam, but also people, they do feel like I do. We don't want to see the destruction of Iraq.
You were the first woman to be put in prison in the United Arab Emirates for writing. Is that right? That you were the first woman whose writing landed her in prison?
Unfortunately, that's right, yeah.
And that was in 1987?
Exactly.
What did you say in the writing that was responsible for the imprisonment?
I don't think that they were intimidated by a specific article or a specific story or a specific poem. It was a trial based on why are you writing? Full stop, you know? They did burn some of my books at that time, but when they kidnapped me and I was put in prison, they did not put me in prison for a certain writing. It was for everything I wrote and everything I wanted to write and everything I probably would write in the future.
Can I ask you to read one of your poems? And I think you've translated one into English. I'm going to ask you to read it first in Arabic and then translate it into English for us.
Medina صامتة حلم أحلم لونا نارا جدارا ونسير في الحلم على حبات التراب. A silent city, a dream. I dream of colors, fire, a wall. And in this dream, we walk touching the earth.
Do you see yourself as part of a larger movement of Arab intellectual dissent, or do you think that Arab intellectuals living in exile who are dissenters are cut off from one another? I mean, is there a sense of an organized movement of Arab intellectual dissent?
I don't think so, Terry, unfortunately. Maybe in the 60s, but I'm 31 years old, and probably the generation who were before me had these kind of movements. But we are the products of the defeats from 1967 to 1991. I think after the collapse of Beirut, Lebanon, and after the collapse of a lot of socialist movements in the Arab world, nationalist movements, there is no longer this kind of trend. It's probably people who think the same, but they don't communicate with each other, and at the end, they don't really communicate with their society, leaving it to bureaucracy or leaving it to Islamic and fundamentalist trends. And I don't think it's just our government that didn't encourage that kind of movement. It's also the West that didn't want to see it during the 70s and the 80s. They were afraid of the Eastern Bloc, the socialist ideas, and they were afraid of pan-Arabism. And so these movements were fought very badly in the political level. I think in the intellectual level, there are writers who do write, but they end up either assassinated or living in exile or worthless, really, in their own societies.
Do you feel that there are any particular obstacles that you are up against as a woman Arab intellectual?
Many. Many obstacles, Terry. I don't know where to begin. I feel sometimes as if I am not living when I am in the Arab world. I feel as if I am a shadow. And I don't think it's a matter of being a shadow to a man as much as a shadow to a whole society, to other women as well. And I get very, very frustrated, and this frustration lately, during the last few years, it does reflect itself over my body. So I do start feeling sick and feeling depressed, hopeless, etc. There are many obstacles, and these obstacles, they don't really stop at the political level only. I, for example, have been unemployed for the last 3 years. I have not been able to make a good personal relationship with a man for the last few years for the same reason. There are so many obstacles. Somehow you become as if you are a deceased person.
When was the last time you were in the country of your birth, the United Arab Emirates?
Last year. I was there last year after an absence of 3 years. I went to visit and to see my mother and to see if I can still be able to work or live there.
And were you?
Not really, no. But still, I'm trying. Not giving up yet.
Writer and poet Dabia Khamis. I spoke with her earlier today from Cairo. In this country, artists are also contributing to the Gulf debate, a poem by Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell. After the short break, this is Fresh Air. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell is spending the month at the McDowell Artist Colony in New Hampshire. He told me he didn't think there would be a war in the Gulf, but hours before it started, when he realized it was imminent, he started writing a poem, and he spent most of his time since working on it. He usually doesn't like to read a poem until he's spent months or even years revising it, but with this poem, it's different, more urgent.
Well, you know, my thoughts were racing and raging, I should say, through my head, and so I thought, well, why not write them rather than suffer them. So I did write this thing in a great rush of outrage and sorrow.
Well, Galway Kinnell, let me ask you to read this poem that you've written, which is called "This War."
Yes. Well, I'm going to the poem is in a very rough draft. I'm going to read part of it and then skip over some parts that are really too disorganized to read on the radio, and then I'll read the the very ending of the poem. It's called This War. In the Baghdad Bazaar 35 years ago, I was bargaining for a big silver samovar. The merchant and I talked it over a long time in the kerosene glare. He was older and seemed a little reckless, like my brother. And he seemed to like me, but to love the samovar. He would not come down much, and being poor, I would not go up much. Finally, we shook hands and laughed at it all, and I walked away. For a moment, as I walked away, I imagined he might call after me, "Wait." But then I knew he would not. They have sent missiles and planes, and they have found the radar installations and the control centers, and they bomb them. They have found the missile sites and the air bases, and they bomb and bomb them. They have found planes on the ground and bomb them. They are trying to bomb the planes in the hardened hangars under the ground. They have found the nuclear weapons plants and the chemical weapons plants, and they bomb them. B-52s saturation bomb the massed troops. Soon helicopters with Gatling guns will come and machine gun the troops. Soon Bradley fighting vehicles and M1A1 tanks with armor-piercing weapons will grind their way toward other tanks with armor-piercing weapons. Soon soldiers will jump from personnel carriers, run, fall flat, shoot, rise, run, get shot, fall, shoot, rise, get shot. This is the battle plan. This is the order of slaughter. It could be there are generals who like this war as a method of weapons testing. It could be the chiefs of the marketing divisions of the weapons industry like the war as a showcase for the merchandise. It could be there are thwarted, angry people who like it because it is a real war and gives them a break from imaginary killing. It could be unjust to say there are television executives who believe this war would be good for business if only the beer companies would see the potential in the slots following shots of soldiers trudging over hot, dry sand. The troops do not think this is good business. They are slightly excited. Adrenaline is the substance that makes wars fightable. They are also afraid, and they know they will be more afraid before Ramadan and the Ides of March have come. I am afraid, and I am sitting beside a fire in a cabin in New Hampshire with snow outside and a forest. A hand from below the bottom of my heart reaches up and clutches at it. I am afraid there are people who lie bleeding and dying or exploded in pieces or who are getting carried away in litters. Not only ours, but theirs too. The fathers and the mothers of children and the sisters and the brothers of children and the children. I do not think we can alter these events that broke the night after the night of the birthday of Martin Luther King. Once started, the fighting must run its course. All of us hope it runs it quick, but quick or slow, each of us must earn the right to look our children in the eye.
I want to ask you about the image in the first verse about bargaining with a merchant in Baghdad for a samovar.
Yeah.
You know, I've read some political columns where people are saying it's like, you know, unfair to characterize Saddam Hussein as you know, a crazy rug merchant who is trying to bargain us down. That's kind of like ethnic stereotyping in a way. And I wonder, in the light of that, how you feel about that image, you know, and how you work through an image like that, you know.
Well, it's true that one, you know, there is the cliche of the bazaar at the heart of much of our thinking about Middle Eastern countries. But, you know, actually the bazaar is the center of much of the commercial life in those cities. And I think of the bazaar as a wonderful place. However, in this case, you know, I always had that hope that that this was a kind of a negotiation of the kind that one might make over a samovar. and that at the last minute, Saddam Hussein would step forward and say, wait, come back, you can have the samovar. But of course, in this opening section of the poem, the speaker realizes that this is not that the war is not a bargaining over an item in a bazaar.
Poet Galway Cannell joins us from WEVO in Concord, New Hampshire. A talk with political cartoonist Dan Wasserman after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Dan Wasserman is a political cartoonist who says he was in shock when the war broke out, feeling outrage and despair. But now he's beginning to find the dark humor in the war. I called him at the Boston Globe, where he's the editorial cartoonist, and I asked him to tell us about the first cartoon he drew after he heard the news.
Well, I heard on the radio driving home from the paper that the bombing of Baghdad had begun, and I turned around and went back into the paper and watched the first announcements. And ended up doing a cartoon of a sad, beleaguered-looking dove in the foreground against a background of bombing raids and explosions and missiles firing. Looking, and the dove is looking out to the viewers, saying, "This is a new world order." So that was my opening salvo on the opening salvos.
Are you having any problem in figuring out what might be considered in bad taste by your readers? Or, you know, what might be very funny but might be offensive on some level, or just really ring the wrong note for people who have loved ones in the Gulf or whatever?
Yeah, no, I think about that a lot.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to be able to criticize the prosecution of the war, either by the politicians or the military, without implying in any way that you're disrespectful of the sacrifices that people in the armed forces are making, or unsympathetic to the kind of pain that this is causing people. One of the things that's bothered me is that people don't seem to register, or not everybody, but few people seem to register that having to start this war was a colossal failure. And a lot of what upsets me about the fact that we've had to take this route as a country is exactly that a lot of people are going to die. So I keep that in mind, and I'm not sure were I a family member or someone serving over there that I would look at my work and be happy about it, but I'm sensitive to that consideration.
I think for any artist, one of the things you really try to get to is what you honestly believe. And what you honestly believe can sometimes really surprise you. I wonder if there's anything that's really giving you trouble with this war, trouble in figuring out what you really make of it, what you really think, if you're surprised at how you think about anything so far.
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and I definitely have been surprised. And I find that I have arguments with myself constantly about what we as a country should be doing. I mean, there's no question but that Saddam Hussein is an evil character. So I go back and forth. I could actually make a strong case for why this war is a good idea, and I do that in order to make sure that I've sort of covered that argument. In a more visceral way, I've been surprised by my reaction to the missile attacks on Israel. And the night of those first attacks, I was very upset and moved by these civilians being bombarded by Hussein's missiles. In a similar way, the POWs, watching these guys being forced to read these statements is just wrenching. So it's sometimes difficult to not go immediately from that sense of sympathy and outrage to saying, well, of course we should be doing this. You know, this guy's got to be stomped on. But it's definitely been a surprising experience sorting all this stuff out day to day.
Dan Wasserman is the editorial cartoonist at the Boston Globe.